Jeff Merrick, you're a man with a lot on his mind. You're a man who watches the games intently, and you're a man who is sometimes irked by the oddest things.
You want to do this now? Oh, by the way, I just saw this. Ross Lounsbery has passed away. Flyers fans would know that name. He played with Rick McLeish on that Flyers squad and Gary Dornhofer. Passed away at the age 67 of cancer. Maybe more on Ross Lounsbery later. But
to bring the room down.
So I just saw it right now. I just saw that, you know, here's...
The only time we ever deal with death on this show is when the Masterton nominations come out. You know
I
that.
Know. Fred Shiro loved this guy, though. Ross Lounsbery. Oh, man. Okay. Not so much a pet peeve, but just, you know, something that once I mention it, you'll go out of your way to notice it. Much like, you know how I always get on my high horse about Original Six? Ugh. Uh-huh. Arbitrary Six, right?
Yeah.
Stanley Cup Finals as opposed to Final. Playing Junior as opposed to playing Juniors.
Ooh.
A conversation with... now, folks, if you don't want me to wreck the game, just for the next couple of minutes, Greg and I are going to talk about something here. Now, if you just want to fast forward the podcast or if you're listening live right now, just turn it off and then come back in about 5 minutes and we'll probably be done with it. As I can almost hear Greg rolling his eyes as I start to spit it out.
I know. I always like this. I always like when you know you have something that's going to be... It's like when you know you're about to hum a song that's going to become an earworm.
Yep, that's right.
And you have a gleeful look in your eye because I know whatever you're going to unleash onto an unsuspecting audience right now is going to be a game changer. It's going to be that moment where a point of demarcation in their lives where they can say, this is my life before this moment, and here is my life after this moment.
Yep, and I still get, you know, Original/Arbitrary Six tweets from everybody, and I love all of them, and I appreciate them, because once you've put that in someone's head, they realize, yeah, what the hell is all this Original Six stupidity all about? So here it is.
Okay, here we go.
So if you're listening on iTunes, fast forward if you don't want to have your hockey broadcasting wrecked for you. John Shannon and I were talking about this on Friday during one of the intermissions of the junior hockey game we were doing. There is something that has crept into sports broadcasting. It's not just hockey, but for our example, we'll use it. And that is one word. And that word is area. Mm-hmm. Area. Pops up everywhere. It's no longer the slot. It's the slot area.
Score slot area, yeah.
Yeah. It's the center ice area.
Area.
It's the trapezoid area. As opposed to, it's the slot, it's center ice, and it's the trapezoid. I guess in a sport that moves so quickly and it's such a so fluid in nature, that I suppose play-by-play guys are, you know, so quick to not really say anything definitive. Everything has to be this sort of vague, you know. We can't do anything really declarative here. It's the slot area. Well, what's the difference between the slot and the slot area? Can you explain that to me, Greg? Now that this is in your ears, by the way, starting tonight in the two games, you will go. I'm waiting for the tweets when someone will say slot area, trapezoid area, whatever area. I'm going to get the tweets about it. I know it, and that's
The way I see it is that the slot is the slot, right? The slot area would be this sort of circle around the slot.
So still the slot. The slot.
You are near the slot. You can see the slot from where you're standing, but maybe you're not in the slot.
Yeah.
In the slot area.
Yeah, okay. Thanks. Just say the slot. We all know what you're talking about. Fired that one from just outside the slot area. What is the slot, slot area as opposed to the slot?
Area.
Yeah. John and I had a good sort of chuckle on that one. And now that you know that, or now that you know that it's a peeve for me, your life will forever be changed listening to sports. And why is that? It falls so short of actually saying something definite. Can't it just be the slots? Can't it just be center ice? I mean, you listen to old-time broadcasters. They have no problem being definitive about the areas that they're talking about.
The areas.
There's another one, see? The area of the ice that they're talking about. They don't have to cloud it with this area nonsense. What do you think? You're going to listen for it tonight? I know you.
I think I'll have to listen for it because I honestly don't have the vehement negative reaction to the word area that you do, nor have I noticed its overuse. So that's why you exist. You exist to – you're like the observational comic. You're like the observation. You're like the Jerry Seinfeld of hockey. You're just good. Oh, you ever notice how when they're talking about the
talking
slot,
about the
they're
area.
Talking about an area? What's with areas?
What is the area?
If I wanted an area, I'd go to an opera. My biggest complaint these days as far as coverage of hockey goes is this, to be quite honest with you.
All right.
It's the word, here's a word that I hate and a word that I see popping up all the time, mostly on social media and mostly as a slap in the face of the traditional and mainstream media, which obviously is something I enjoy, but I'm getting tired of seeing the word narrative. Well, congratulations. I guess we have a new narrative. Oh, I guess the narrative was wrong. You know, they try so hard to force this narrative on people, and look what happened. What we have here in the usage of the word narrative is this. It's like when somebody says, when they're asked about the existence of God, they're like, I don't believe anything. I don't believe in anything. Well, yes, you do. You believe that you have a belief that is that there is no God. So there is a belief in something, right? So the idea that there can't be a narrative, or that the narrative is bucked, or that narratives are stupid, isn't of itself a narrative. Yes? Isn't someone saying, well, the narrative is that Sidney Crosby is the best offensive player in the world, and therefore, or the narrative is that Sidney Crosby's offensive slump is crushing the Penguins, but it actually isn't.
But where does that contempt usually come from? That contempt usually comes from the analytics crowd. And you can make the argument that analytics is just
you're saying it's an analytics crowd thing? Is that why I keep seeing it?
Don't you think? That's where I normally see it from. Well, here's the narrative the MSM are trying to spoon feed you, but here's the actual facts.
Right. Their narrative.
Mm-hmm.
I guess their use of the word narrative is to say that something is false.
It's just not
founded on fact.
Narrative has become it's become pejorative, right? When you say, "Oh, that's the narrative." Well, I guess another dumb narrative from the media.
Mm-hmm.
When really all they are conversations trying to describe what is there. This is what I maintain. This is what I maintain on the podcast.
I didn't want to make this another analytic thing. But you might be right. That might be why I see it so often, is because it does become the providing needles for balloons thing is becoming a, well, here's the actual facts behind what you perceive to be the narrative of the series and actually is not. So you might be right.
And all it is,
I hate the word.
Everybody, yeah, I know, it's getting a little tiresome. But, I mean, everybody has their own way to describe what they just saw. We talked about this last week, I think, when we talked about symbols a little bit, and that all that really life is, and really that, in a lot of ways, all that Greg Wyshynski is and all that Jeff Merrick is are symbols. There are roles that you play. You're playing the role of Greg Wyshynski right now, and I'm playing the role of Jeff Merrick. You know, there are essentially, I don't get too into this, but there are essentially two eyes in everyone. There's the eye that is projected publicly, and then there's the eye that you can kind of understand internally, but can never really approach in the same way that you can't bite your own teeth.
You're bringing up something interesting in the sense that there is always persona at work, and I feel like being on this show and doing the Puck Daddy blog, that whole notion has sometimes been completely ignored by some people. Like, I have a feeling in just some of the interactions that I've had with people who dislike me or dislike the work or whatever, like they think that me trolling about the Nets beating the Raptors on Sunday is like how I am at all times. Like, I'll be at a diner and they'll give me a plate of pancakes and I'll be like, you know, these pancakes are awful. What are you, Canadian? Like, it's like, I don't get it. Like, obviously there is some level of persona at play here to make a radio show entertaining, to engage people. I've grown up arguing on the internet, so I am just an agent of provocation when it comes to certain things. And I'm also very stubborn and love to enter debates with people and eventually force my will onto them and win an argument. So all these things combined create a very grating persona. I will fully admit that I am a very grating persona.
But that's not who
you
are.
But at the end of the day, it's a persona. I mean, I think that sometimes it becomes hard for me sometimes when things get personal, you know, and sometimes it gets personal with you too. I know with people disliking you, it's very hard to be like, I dislike you, or you're a, I got called a fag the other day, or stuff like that, and you're like, you know nothing of me, but you know that this thing that exists in my professional life that is not exactly curated by me, but just sort of kind of where my persona has gone as a professional, is it creates this sense of like hatred. Just like, are you like, if we saw each other in a bar, you'd punch me in the face? Like, I don't know. It becomes a very bizarre. You're right about persona. It becomes a very bizarre thing. And I think the weird thing for me is that, like, I think people, and maybe, and I think this goes for anybody that kind of does what we do, people think it's very calculated. And for me, it's just kind of not. It's just sort of like the way I am, you know, the way I am on social media, the way I write, the way I have very low tolerance for things in life, and low tolerance for stupidity, or low tolerance for people that are ignorant of context. Like, I just kind of how I am persona-wise, but like...
But the thing,
it's
thing about
like the Howard Stern, it's the Howard Stern conundrum. It's like how he is one way on the air and then was another way at home, and that was always his thing. That's the basis of Private Parts. The basis of Private Parts is the dichotomy of Howard Stern, that on the air he is one way, away from the mic he's another way. And I think for most people, there's different shades of it. I mean, I think that there are elements of truth in everybody's persona, but by no means are we the person that we put out there on the blog or on
nobody
the
is no nobody on
especially
my
especially on Twitter
nobody on my Twitter timeline. You know, I'll read the names that are in front of me right now. Lexi's right in front of me. Corey Snodden's right in front of me. Yankee Zed, or Yankee Z, I suppose, if you're American. Yankee Z in front of me on my Twitter time. John Roberts, Brendan Milhauser, right? Joe Pack, Greg M, Kings of Hollywood. Like, none of these people are who they project on Twitter. None of these people are who they project publicly. That's why I keep going back to that. And the Howard Stern point is the same of all of us. In every single interaction, can you honestly say to yourself, I am the same person with everybody else that I interact with? No. No, you're not.
No.
That's why you can't really describe what is happening in your life at one specific moment, because it's a complex series of relationships with everything around you. And if you talk about yourself, you can't help but talking about the context within which you exist. And so in order to describe it accurately, Greg, you would have to live to be a million years old. And even then, you wouldn't be able to describe it, because it'd be too many things going on at the same time. And everyone changes when they go home. I mean, and even when you get home, are you the exact same person to your wife, to your husband, to your kids, that you are to your cousins? You're not. And it completely changes, and it completely evolves. And all throughout the day, you know, what's happening is you're entering a whole sort of network of relationships with people, and you're a different person every time you experience A, a thing, or B, a person, because your context has changed, and you've changed along with it.
Right.
So to think that Greg Wyshynski on Twitter or on this podcast or on Puck Daddy is that same guy you're going to meet, you know, at a bar having a plate of fries and a cold beer is ridiculous, because you will you will have to be a different person because a new relationship you've entered in.
Right. I guess you know, the thing for me has always been like, I found a kinship maybe with the people who tolerate me, but generally don't like me. And I'll tell you where I found this kinship. As a Brooklyn Nets fan, I have found exactly the vibe that some people have about like me, which is like, he's a really annoying whatever person, but he's a hockey guy and I like the blog, so I'm going to tolerate him. As a Brooklyn Nets fan, I hate this team.
Really?
I hate this team. Oh God, I hate this team.
Why? I know. Sweet tweet about basketball. Tell me why.
Okay. Well, it's one of these situations, and I think hockey fans have experienced this in different forms throughout your history of rooting for a team. The Nets are a mercenary bunch. They're a collection of egos. They bought Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett, two players I don't like necessarily, from the Boston Celtics. Their payroll is super high to the point where they pay luxury tax on top of luxury tax. Mm-hmm. They're kind of a team that you don't like. D. Will, their point guard, is a guy I never liked. Like, I don't like the team, but I'm a Nets fan.
But they're your team.
They're my team, right. It's the team I've come to root for since the 1980s. So no matter what the personnel on the team is going to be, I'm going to ultimately have their back and hope for the best and hope that maybe this mix is better than I think it is. Now, when it all goes south, then you're like, well, I hated this team to begin with, and I knew they were never going to succeed. And that's the whole thing. But it's this notion of like, it's this notion of holding your nose, you know? And I think, you know, watching that game on Sunday, where the Nets beat the Raptors, there was this element of holding your nose when Paul Pierce, the player that I've never liked and always considered a rival and never really thought was, you know, from my understanding of his persona, the most upstanding citizen, makes the quintessential play in the game, a defensive play that wins a series.
That was one at the end? Where you blocked Kyle Lowry?
I have to be like, wow, this guy did really well for my team, but at the end of the day, I hate my team. I think there has to be examples for all of you out there of times in your lives as fans when you've rooted for a team where you love your franchise, you love the symbol on the front, you love some of the names in the back, but ultimately, whether it's because of the style of hockey they play, whether it's because of the people that are on the team, whether it's because of one individual on the team or one individual behind the bench, you don't like that incarnation of the team. And you know what's funny? I was talking to somebody the other day about the Toronto Maple Leafs and about the fact that Pension Plan Puppets, my good friends, the Toronto bloggers for SB Nation, it was one of the few times, it was the only time actually, we've allowed the fans of a team to eulogize their own team. I thought it'd be really cool for the Triple P boys to do it because they're so caustic and they're so cynical about the Leafs that it would be really entertaining to read it, right?
Right.
And then what happened was this incarnation of the Leafs that they were so cynical about and they absolutely despised for most of the season made the playoffs for the first time in several years, went on this amazing run against the Bruins, and then had their soul crushed. And so when it came time to put pen to paper for the Triple P boys, it wasn't the same. They couldn't do it. They couldn't force themselves to hate this team because they actually wound up loving it. And
you
so
know,
it became one of these great moments. And like I thought to myself, like there have been times like that for me where I've wanted to hate a team, but I end up loving it. And there have been times for me where I've wanted to love a team, but I end up hating it because the mix was wrong. I'll give you the best example. Doug Gilmour is a player that I've loved throughout my entire life as a hockey fan.
Mm-hmm.
But when he was with Jersey, I was sort of mezzo about him. I wasn't a big fan of his when he was in Jersey.
But he was on the
reason.
Back nine then. I mean.
I know that. And it was – well, so was – but so was Stasny when he came to the Devils, and I wound up loving him when he was at the Devils. Bernie Nichols is a guy that I also didn't like when he was at the Devils. Again, later in the career, what have you.
Yeah.
But just didn't fit. So it's expectation. It's everything else. But the Nets – this Nets team, do you know how hard it was for me to sit there on Sunday and root for this collection of mercenary – assholes that are getting billions of dollars at the end of their career because some Russian maniac bought the team and decided he wanted to buy a championship versus this adorable Toronto team that had made the playoffs the first time in ages and had fans stretching from the Air Canada Center to the friggin' airport in the middle of the river. It was insane how – and it was so hard for me to root against Toronto because, like, that's the team – that's the Blue Jackets. That's the team I'd be rooting for if they weren't playing my team. And how hard is it to root for my team? I hate my team, and this other thing is so beautiful. It was like seeing a beautiful blossoming flower next to stinkweed. But because stinkweed was your stinkweed, you had to put that over to flower.
I am so glad I'm not a fan of a team and I can just watch sports because, man, it's got to be so painful. And how about this one? I know a lot of Maple Leafs fans. I lived in Toronto my whole life. I have plenty of Maple Leafs fans who love the personalities on that 93 team, right? You mentioned Gilmour, you throw Clark in there, Dave Andrechuk, Felix Potvin, all of it. You know, if you're our friend Sean in Ottawa, Down Goes Brown, you love Sylvain Lefebvre because Down Goes Brown in the Rob Brown fight. But those same people are conflicted because as much as that team was fun for them and they won games and they got to the conference final, the style of play was suffocating. You know, it's like almost like a dirty secret amongst Leafs fans. Well, you know, they played hard trap hockey. Shh, 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 shh. We don't say that. That's what New Jersey did. That's not the Maple Leafs. I remember Waters telling me once when I was working with him at 640. I said, well, man, that 93 run, I mean, God bless you, but it was some painful hockey to watch. I said, oh, man, me and Burns used to laugh afterwards and go, you know, these people love it. We're winning games and all that, but we're just choking the life out of hockey. We're completely strangling the game.
one of the examples I thought of in this whole notion of, like, you love your team, but you hate this incarnation of it, it's got to be the Dale Hunter Capitals. Like, I imagine a Capitals fan that had been hoping and praying for, you know, the glory days of the Fire Wagon, Rock the Red Capitals days, see this Hunter team, see the way they play, see the handcuffs on Ovechkin, and yet they're winning. And you're like, oh, this is so exciting, winning, but at the expense of every single thing I loved about the franchise.
Okay, but that's where it comes back. That's where it comes back to, what do you actually love about hockey? Do you love your team or do you love the game?
Oh. That's a great question.
There are still plenty of fans, when their team is out, so are they. They've bailed.
Oh, God. And listen, all due respect to Raptors fans, I'd love to see what the Toronto ratings for the NBA going forward will be after Sunday.
Yeah,
I'm sure they'll tune in for the Miami series to see them eviscerate the Nets. But no, that's a good point. And I think that...
Hold on to it. Hit pause. Okay. Introduce our guest today.
Joining us now on the line, a man who was doing some national work during the playoffs, but you may know him as the color voice of the Carolina Hurricanes. Here to talk about the nearly clean sweep of the coaching staff today in Carolina, outside of a good friend of the general manager, Rod Brind'Amour. He is Tripp Tracy, and he joins us now on the Merrick vs. Wyszynski podcast. Hello, Tripp. How are you?
Hey, Greg. How you doing? Hi, Jeff.
Hey, what's up, Tripp? Good to hear from you again, as always. Your initial thoughts when the news broke late this morning, was what, Tripp?
My initial thought was I was mildly surprised, because when you look at some of the commentary down the stretch, when owner Peter Karmanis was actually with the team on a late road trip to Manhattan, that he really seemed to endorse the coaching staff and Jim Rutherford before the switch happened in management, seemed to say some really good things as well. So because of that, I'm mildly surprised, but thought that there was a good chance of this happening when Ron Francis was introduced as the general manager of the hockey club, that he was going to take some time and deliberate what the next appropriate move was and is with this staff. And having had a chance to talk to Ron this morning, just as he just told the press in his press conference down in Raleigh, this was a very difficult decision. He loved the work ethic. He loved the character of Kirk Muller, who doesn't, and John McClain and Dave Lewis, but just felt a fresh approach was needed at this point in time. And we can throw out every name in the book, guys that played with Ronnie as maybe prime candidates, but I certainly now get the feeling that it's going to be a process to see which coach really fits what Ron's looking for in the direction of the Hurricanes.
It obviously helps when you've got a guy who played in the NHL for like 20 some odd years. He's played with everybody, so there's a number of connections you can draw. What in your opinion happened with Muller? Because I was looking back at my initial post on Muller getting hired by the Hurricanes, and I thought it was a coup at the time. I mean, he was like the rock star assistant coach for the Canadiens. He was short on head coaching experience, but it didn't seem like it was going to be an issue. He was going to be so good with the players. Where did Kirk Muller go wrong? Was it a coaching thing, or was it simply just this was a bad mix of players?
Okay, so for me, the best Kirk Muller coaching moments is when he didn't worry about almost when he had nothing to lose. And I remember late in the year, he said, losing's for losers. And what made Kirk such a great NHL player and a Stanley Cup champion as he was in Montreal. And that was really forcing, and challenging the cultural changes that needed and need to happen with the Hurricanes. Those were the moments as the color analyst on the hockey club that I was most proud of what he was doing behind the bench. Because the reality is this is a team they were a salary cap team this year. They actually have been a salary cap team for a lot of the recent years. A couple of years they've been more budget conscious, but they've been right up against the cap more years than not. Mm-hmm. And so much of that money has been tied up into their offense. And they just didn't score goals the way that you projected them to score, whether it be Eric Staal, whether it be Jordan Staal, whether it be Alex Semin. Jeff Skinner showed me a ton of hope late in the year. And when I say that, what frustrated me most, and Ron Francis just alluded to it in his press conference, is they didn't play the right way on enough nights. They would have stretches that where they would take care of their own end first. They would do the little things that allow you to stay in hockey games over the course of 82 when you're not going to have your A game every night. And once they'd have success with that, they'd abandon it. Whether that was selfishness, whether it was lack of mental and physical preparation, their practice habits, I just don't know. But that was the most frustrating thing for me to watch as the analyst for the team. The things to point to, I think, that had a lot to do with this change that Ron decided to make is their home record was not good. It was a 500 record, and that's been something that has plagued the Hurricanes really for the majority of the season since they won the Cup in 2006. They haven't been a good home team, and their power play wasn't any good. When you look at their percentages in special teams, they were well under that benchmark that teams want, the combination of 100% or better. They did have a great year in shorthanded goals. But even when the Hurricanes have gone to conference finals, two Stanley Cup finals and one Stanley Cup championship, I don't remember many years where their power play has really been there or near the top of the league. And then the last thing I'd say is that when Kirk came in, you really, really hoped that the power of identification, an OHL product like Eric Staal, a centerman like Eric Staal, would have a profoundly positive impact on Eric's game, really, really taking big steps to being dominant the way he has been at times in his career. It started well. It did not continue to go as well as it needed to. And I don't mean to point out Eric Staal, but for Eric, for Jordan, for Semin, Skinner showed me a ton of hope late in the season with young Elias Lindholm. These are the players that are going to have to be your best players, as well as what's going to happen with Cam Ward as Anton Khudobin grabbed the ball and ran with it. Because we could, it's cliche, but I think we all know a coach is as good as his starting goaltender, and a coach is as good as his top players. Otherwise, things like this happen.
Well, Tripp, I was going to get there with you, too. I'm glad you brought it up. The old saying, show me a good goalie, I'll show you a good coach. And as an old ECAC goaltender yourself at a Harvard, how much of Kirk McLean's fortunes were pinned to insufficient goaltending?
Muller.
I was. It's funny because when I was in college, I had a poster of Kirk McLean in his Vancouver jersey on the wall. I would say that this year I can't fault the goaltending really as a culprit for this, because even though they had injuries to their top two guys, Justin Peters was as good of a goalie as there was in hockey from mid-November through Christmas, and Anton Khudobin was not just the goalie of the month, but the player of the month in the month of January. And when you look at his save percentage throughout the course of the year, he's right there in the league leader. So I don't pin this on goaltending this year. Cam Ward has been a problem. He's been a problem because he's been inconsistent. And you can point to his health. I said earlier today that the top goalies in this league, one of the biggest common denominators that you hear about is their competitive edge in practices, whether it be Carey Price, whether it be last year's Vezina winner, Sergei Bobrovsky. You heard about it, about Dominic Hasek through the years, that never wanted to allow anybody to score in practice. Henrik Lundqvist, you hear about it telling shooters, hey, if you're going to shoot high in the games, shoot high in practice, because that makes us both better. It has very little to do this particular season with their goaltending, although Cam Ward certainly leaves you wanting more and it's going to be an interesting offseason. Did he get through adversity this year? He was challenged by Khudobin. Will it make him better? And will that make him better in Carolina or elsewhere? To me, this comes down to their special team success or lack thereof. Even above that, their home record, which has not been anything to write home about. And that gets to the mental and physical preparation that allows you to be consistent, that I think was probably the biggest thread in Ron Francis having to make this call that I think was a difficult one for him to make so early on the job.
And you're right. I mean, you look at the 3 years of Muller in Carolina, the first 2 years, their defense, I think, was in the bottom third of the league, maybe even like bottom five in one of those seasons, and then it flipped this year. Now, all of a sudden, the defense was okay, but the goal scoring is what completely fell off the shelf, and all of a sudden, that was in the bottom third. So it was an interesting little flip this year. What kind of coach do you think he's going to go for? I mean, I know you can't climb into the mind of a rookie GM and really figure this out, but do you think that they opt more for someone who has head coaching experience because of the inexperience with Mueller maybe being a factor in his demise? Or do you think that they go with somebody maybe younger, an assistant that can grow with this team a little bit?
Boy, Greg, that's going to be a question that everybody is obviously going to be asking. And my best answer is this. Ron, just in his press conference, without getting himself into trouble, because, you know, there are head coaches and assistant coaches that are part of teams that are still playing right now and are employed by the 29 other franchises around the National Hockey League, that Francis will want his new guy to emulate in some form or fashion. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that he's talking about the Joel Quenvilles and the Dave Tippetts of the world. I mean, I know that he's especially close with Ulf Samuelsson, who's a fine young assistant coach, obviously, with Alain Vigneault in New York. Kevin Dineen is a guy that's available right now that Ron played with, was the first captain in Hurricanes franchise history when the team moved from Hartford. Those are just a couple of names. For me, Rob Brind'Amour, at any point, if he chooses that he wants to be a head coach, I think Rob Brind'Amour will be an exceptional head coach, and I say that for a few reasons. We all know about his legendary fitness and his compete that you could count on every time that he put on an NHL uniform. But Rod is a much better communicator than people give him credit for. The players in that dressing room, when Rod would run a power play or penalty killer, the meeting that rotated before every game, they really marveled at how good his meeting was in the way that it was conveyed with the substance and the approach. And Brind'Amour has that hockey IQ that I think at some point will make him a great head coach. But I still think Ronnie is probably going to bring Rod down to the bench and assist whoever the new coach will be. If Ron goes with a guy that I think if I had to bet, I would say that it's more of a likelihood than not, a player or a coach that he knows through playing together, that they would have built the type of trust that you need. That coach is going to need the backing of Ron Francis to truly coach these players with zero special treatment whatsoever. I mean, I agree with the John Wooden line, is you don't treat every player the same. You treat that player in a way that's going to best benefit the hockey club. But at the same time, the Hurricanes need to be a group that you can count on, and that people around the National Hockey League say that team is going to play the same way every night, whether they're up a goal, whether they're down a goal, whether they're playing their third game in four nights, or they've been off for two or three days resting. That's the type of game that Carolina has not played the last couple of years that has been their biggest Achilles heel. That's the type of game that Ron Francis did play in his Hall of Fame career and will be the biggest component in what he expects from his new coach.
Do we see personnel changes next year, Shep? I mean, of the big guys, you know, the two Stalls and Skinner and Semin, do we see Cam Ward? How many familiar faces are back, or how many do you think leave?
Jeff, I think that everybody's on the table at this point in time. And so any of those guys could be moved. Boy, you just look at it. Cam Ward has 2 years left on his contract. Hudobin, I thought Jimmy Rutherford and assisted by Ron, really good contract at the end of the year. I believe in the upside of Hudobin. For Eric, I think it has to be a mindset. It has to be a mindset that I'm going to be a plus player, and the endorsements and support from up above that, if you're a plus player and it means you're going to get less offensive production, that we can live with that. I believe if he is a plus player, he'll actually generate more goals and assists and points and help the team be significantly better. Jordan, they need him to check first, and if he checks first, I think there's a reason he's been one of the top penalty killers in the game, because when he has that mindset, he's been a threat shorthanded for how many seasons, dating back to the Stanley Cup Finals in 2009 when he turned the series for Pittsburgh. Semin was injured for a lot of this year. Semin, at times, his shifts go through the roof in how long they are, and beats to his own drum. He can't do that. has 4 years left remaining on his contract. He still will always woo you with his skill level, which is maybe more than anybody I've seen. I just don't like it when the Hurricanes have traded players at their low point, Jeff. Don't make a trade just for the sake of making a splash. And I have complete confidence that Ron Francis won't do that. And obviously it's not easy to move some of these bigger type contracts that they do have. Skinner showed a ton of hope in the last month of the season with their first round pick, Elias Lindholm, that Jeff is starting to show a commitment to play the game in other ways than just the passion and electrifying ability that he has to score goals. If that continues, that will really help this team get back towards the playoffs.
Last one for me, Tripper, thanks for joining us today. What's the most impressive thing that you've seen in your playoff coverage so far around this great National Hockey League of ours?
It ties right into this. I mean, I had the ability to have a bird's eye view between the two benches for NBC Inside the Glass of the Colorado Avalanche and the Minnesota Wild, and it was the overall commitment of these young stars. I mean, for Colorado, it was Nathan MacKinnon and that it factor, where he's not cocky, but just completely believed, especially the beginning of that series, and then in Game 5, that he could be the difference in the game. It was Ryan O'Reilly, not the greatest skater, but he does everything right with body position, with his hockey IQ and his stick on both sides of the puck. You know, if I could watch a Carolina team that does that, boy, I'm looking forward to next season. And then a guy that needs to get going for Minnesota as this series shifts home from Chicago, Mikhail Granlund. A guy that's like Paul McCartney and John Lennon with his popularity in Finland. In games 3 and 4 for the Wild, you saw the type of difference maker that he is offensively, but then blocking shots to preserve a one-goal lead in the last minute of play. I mean, that's the type of complete hockey that I really, really enjoyed by such good young players, but not in a one-trick pony or, you know, one-facet type thing. It was complete hockey, and that was my biggest takeaway from what I thought was just a stellar series.
So then last one here, Tripp, who's the best you've seen? Who do you think comes out on top?
It'd be tough, Jeff, to go against the Chicago Blackhawks at this point in time. I mean, they have so many weapons that play the right way offensively. Their blue line is deeper than anybody else out there, and they've got the star-studded nature of the blue liners up top, Keith and Seabrook. And then Corey Crawford. I mean, when are we going to start believing in this guy? And Jeff, you know, just to pick one guy, you could pick Osa, but I'll pick Jonathan Toews. I truly believe Jonathan Toews is one of those rare hockey players that, as long as the team is winning in the regular season or in the playoffs, 5 games go by and he has no goals, no assists, I don't think it phases him one bit. He doesn't start to feel the pressure to produce, which leads to cheating. He plays the same way because he knows that gives the team the best chance at winning and him the best chance at producing. And that's the ideology that you know, the Hurricanes are going to need across the board to get back to where they want to start getting to at the beginning of next year.
Awesome stuff. Sure, Tracy, amazing insight. The Carolina fans in our audience are just drooling on their laptops and their tablets right now over the things that you've said. And thank you so much for joining us. We'll have you back sooner than later.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, Jeff. Have a good day, guys.
Thanks, Tripp. Take care, bud.
He brings up a good point about great players, and they have that ability to just stay the course even if things aren't going well. And I think that's what we're seeing in Pittsburgh. You know, it's not as if Sid's a liability, despite not scoring a goal for 13 games.
I thought he had a hell of a game yesterday.
He's a guy that's not going to mope around. I know that there's been some footage of him yelling at Bilesma. There's been some footage of him kind of skating slowly on the back end of a defensive play, which, had he been Russian. But overall, I think he's still playing extraordinarily well despite not cashing in the goal department. And, you know, it's interesting. If you look back at his last huge drought that he had, and I want to say it was back 2011, something like, somewhere around that neighborhood. I read about it on Puck Daddy over the weekend. He had a lot more assists during that drought than he does this time around. But he's not playing poorly, and the Penguins obviously are still winning for the most part. So I don't think him and Taves can do that. You know, they can go and not. And Sid did it in the Olympics, too. Remember? I mean, his eye was not an offensive juggernaut in the Olympics.
Twice.
Twice, exactly. But he played well. And it wasn't as if he was, like I said, a liability. It wasn't as if people were saying drop him down to the fourth line. He does things away from the puck and when he's not scoring that make him a tremendously great player, and Taves is the same way.
Here's what happened yesterday.
But goddamn. Hold on. Before we get off the Taves thing for a second. We've talked on this show a lot of times about Marian Hossa and the Selke.
Uh-huh.
And how it's a shame
and a sham
that because he's not a center, he doesn't get the same acknowledgement. The two plays he made defensively, definitive plays, in that game against the Wild, game two, were incredible. The breakout play he made with the puck on that Bickle goal was ridiculous.
And the pass to feed it to him. And by the way, I don't think Brizgalov has moved his glove yet. Did he even try? Did he even try to catch that?
It was sick to see a guy who can possess the puck and maneuver his way out of his own zone, mm-hmm, and create his own 2-on-1 is what Hossa did from defensive play to offense, transition play, create his own 2-on-1. It was sick.
Okay, go to Taves on that play, though, because there was a big – and, man, Suter was hot about it, and rightfully so.
Oh, God, and he had every right to be, too, though.
Of course, but that's Jonathan Taves saying, I know this isn't going to be a penalty. This is away from the puck, and I'm going to make sure this stays a 2-on-1. And did he trip him? Absolutely he did. Completely. But it kept that as a 2-on-1. Now, the other great Hossa play, and I know it's an empty net goal, but a lot of guys just would have turned, and Hossa comes steaming back into the zone, grabs the puck. A lot of guys would have turned and fired back down the ice. I'm talking about the Brandon Saad goal. The little bounce off the boards. Is there a team?
Yeah.
I've talked about this on the podcast before. I mean, Joel Quenneville, flush the boards, flush the boards, flush the boards. I mean, the Chicago Blackhawks, and this is a hallmark of all Joel Quenneville teams, whether it's Colorado, whether it's St. Louis, or now it's the Chicago Blackhawks. Sticks on the boards. They come out with the puck. And then what do they do with it? I don't know that there's a team in the NHL that uses the boards to make passes more than the Chicago Blackhawks. And mm-hmm. You saw it on the empty netter with Brandon Saad. Most guys would just fire it. He just lays this perfectly weighted puck along the boards that Saad can catch up to for the empty net goal. And he does it with like this nonchalance that you just don't see in the NHL. That's a really sophisticated play. And to watch Marian Hossa do it, he's snapping twigs. No big deal. Three assists at the end of the game. Probably the best defensive forward of both teams in the entire matchup.
And if you're Chuck Fletcher, what do you do? You just sit there and you sit back and you're like, well, wish we had better players.
Yeah. You say, well,
the Blackhawks have so many guys.
Maybe Granlund will be that good one day. Maybe Coyle will be that good one day.
But the Blackhawks just have guys that for whatever reason, whatever is in their DNA, and maybe it's the incredible use of analytics from Stan Bowman that was in an awesome article by Mark Lazarus in the Sun-Times recently. They just have guys that know how to do this. They know how to win. They figured it out. The Kings are the same way. If you're the Sharks watching the Kings, what are you doing? You're saying to yourself, well, they just know how to do this better than we do. We don't have that thing that they have, whatever it is.
And isn't it interesting that we say, oh, you know, parity, it's jump ball every year. Any team can win. It's great. The salary cap has leveled the playing field. Again, we could very well be looking at Los Angeles, Chicago, Boston, and Pittsburgh.
Right.
Like there are really.
And what is the commonality in those teams?
Defensemen.
And also, the 1-2 punch, Bergeron, Krejci.
Yeah.
Sid Malkin.
Mm-hmm.
Kopitar, Richards. Well, okay.
Kopitar's
except for
been
Chicago.
Awesome. Kopitar's been freaking awesome. And then Jonathan Taves and mystery
Jonathan
sentiment
Taves
number two.
And your name.
Well, here's the thing about
hold that thought for 1 second. The Conn Smythe thing for the Blackhawks right now is ridiculous. Like, I think Taves is probably their leading candidate based on everything he does, and he's got the numbers for it. He's got 3 game winners and an overtime winner.
And a big trip.
Kane's right with him.
Yeah.
Hossa is right with him. Crawford's right with him. What do you make of the candidacy of Brent Seabrook?
Yeah, he's been really good. Even though he's lost half a step along the way, he's still really good.
He's lost half a step, but he's their leading scorer defensively. Mm-hmm. I think he's got 8 or 9 points. Mm-hmm. And we come back to one of our favorite topics, Jeff Merrick. How do you process illegality? Because let's face it, we might still be playing that Blues series were it not for the fact that Seabrook took out Backes. And can you factor that into a Conn Smythe candidacy if you took out the best player on another team, ripped their heart out like Mola Ram and Temple of Doom, and have the points to go along with that action? I mean, he's the real weird one as far as like MVP, but that's getting ahead of ourselves, obviously. I mean, what kind of idiot would post a Conn Smythe watch every morning throughout the playoffs, ranking different players based on what happened the previous night? What kind of short-sighted moron would possibly do that, Jeff Merrick?
I don't know. Someone whose initials rhyme with Greg Wyshynski. Here's the thing about Taves as well. You're right. Doesn't matter. He goes 5 games without a point. Whoop-de-doo. Every time Zach Parise was on the ice, who was on the ice against him? Jonathan Taves. Every time he was out there, boom, there's Taves. I don't think he cares at all if he scores points. I know they would like him to, but he does the quote-unquote all those things away from the puck that coaches just love. Whether it's that sneaky Ryan Suter trip or shutting down Zach Parise, he does all of it.
I think they need him to in certain situations. Like, for example, if it was the Kings, if it was the Bruins, I think they need that offense. If it's the Wild, I think you can afford to have Taves hold the Parise line in check and then be confident that your depth is good enough to win the series. And so far it's been that way. The other series, obviously, Marian Gaborik, the size and enormity of Dean Lombardi's boner after game one, after your deadline acquisition ties and wins the game, thank you very much. Holy smokes. That is a dark suit night, to use your term, sir.
I like that, dark suit night. Having said that about Gaborik, it's fantastic. 7 seconds to go. This thing's wrapped up. Time for home. Just go home, kiddies. We're going to bed. Gaborik's got other ideas. How about Kopitar? How about that pass?
Oh, yeah.
How about that pass? How many people make
Kopitar's
that? Here's the thing about Kopitar.
My clubhouse leader right now for Conn Smythe. He's had the best playoff.
Yeah, he has. This is the best hockey we've seen. And I think the Olympics helped him a lot, where he was taking an entire, not just team, but country on his back. Like, he just came back from the Olympics. Not a different player, because I was always in Kopitar, but just a player with more confidence. And how much more evolved. I mean, I swear in Los Angeles, the echoes of Terry Murray screaming at him to come down low for the first pass are still, echoing throughout the Staples Center. But now, how quick does Kopitar get down there to take that first pass? Terry Murray could never get him to do that, ever. He has become, one of the most complete centermen in the game. As we talk about Taves, I think we talk about Kopitar as well, because he's become that kind of player.
Yeah, he's entered the pantheon of the top centers in the game without question. Rangers-Pittsburgh, we talked about Sid. I thought that the Penguins overall were lucky not to be down 2-0 leaving Pittsburgh. That could have been anybody's game last night.
It was a power play.
Yep.
The Rangers had a power play.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, exactly. But again, if you're Henrik Lundqvist, at what point do you start stroking your gorgeous beard and saying to yourself, history is once again repeating, I have a 940-something even strength save percentage, and I'm not getting the goals that I need to win these games? It's not as bad as it used to be with Tortorella.
No, it's not as bad as it used to be. And I'm still scratching my head about Rick Nash, although the more the games go on, the more that we see him play, the more I think that many people's concussion theory is correct, because things do change when you go through something like that.
When you're on your fifth or sixth.
Yeah, it just can't help but change. I don't know. I mean, I'm not willing to write them off just yet at all. Mm-hmm. I still think there's too much firepower there, and there's too many good defensemen on that team. I'm not there yet.
Speaking of Rangers, and we should have brought this up with Tripp a couple minutes ago, Ulf Samuelsson. What do you think of Ulfi as a potential head coaching candidate, as half the league is now looking for a head coach?
And here's the interesting stat. My buddy Stan Mrazek, who does research for Hockey Night tweeted this one out a while ago. Only seven coaches have been with their team in the NHL right now more than three seasons.
Wow.
You know who nailed it, Wish? Like right out of the gate, right out of the lockout in 2005, Pat Quinn. Here's what Pat Quinn said. I'm paraphrasing. It's going to be open season on coaches now that we have a salary cap, because when the money is fixed, you can't spend your way out of problems, and who's going to hang for it? Coaches.
Mm-hmm.
And there were the two freaks, right? Trotz and Ruff. But other than that, Quinn's been right on.
Mm-hmm.
Quinn has been bang on. The salary cap meant more than anything else, it is open season on coaches.
And, you know, we've seen some general managers get canned, but at the end of the day, they always have that excuse, don't they? It works the other way, too. You know, my hands are tied. These contracts, we had to give them out. What was the alternative?
No choice.
Let them walk away with no compensation. We had to give them the contracts, and now look at the salary cap and where it is. It's not my fault.
Mm-hmm.
It's the CBA's fault,
obviously.
Yeah. Boston and Montreal has been as amazing, contentious, nasty, unpredictable as we all wanted it to be. Now we have entered into the glorious feuding between Michel Therrien and Claude Julien, in which one team is lucky, the other team, you make your own luck, one team is bitching about the officiating, the other team, Therrien is like, well, that's just what Boston does, which is completely accurate. We are getting now to the pot is boiling, Jeff Merrick.
Mm-hmm.
The pot is definitely boiling. You can see some of the bubbles.
Players ducking out of checks.
Yeah. Oh, what is that about? Dello's got a great post on that today, by the way, about the history of hitting in the NHL,
mm-hmm.
and the notion of players ducking out of checks. Which, how do you feel? Do you feel that's an issue of valor? Taking the hit?
No.
No, it's
you're gonna get
right.
Run. If someone's gonna run at you, I'm under no obligation to stand there and like a frickin' statue and take it. Sorry, if I can get out of the way, even if that does mean dropping down an octave.
Yeah.
Sorry. If you're gonna take a run at me, I can't get my stick up in your face or an
I'm
elbow up.
Listen, I know that like people remember when the whole fighting debate was raging earlier this season, and people were taking runs at us about being Neanderthalic and out of our element and sure. You know, men lost in time. I'm starting to really feel bad for Sean Thornton. Like, I feel like Sean Thornton is playing a style and acting by a moral code that simply doesn't exist anymore. Don't you at some point?
Yeah, but then Subban went out and apologized to him for ducking out of the hit.
Yeah, that's true.
Like if Subban didn't apologize, then I would have been fine with it.
But don't you feel like it's like he's like the guy rolling up his sleeves outside the bar, being like, "Come here and take it like a man, fight like a man."
Well, take this disagreement outside, sir.
Meanwhile, you're back at your car, slowly dialing 911 on your cell phone and grabbing a tire iron in case the guy jumps you from behind.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of feel like he's a man out of time right now, and I'm, you know. That's sort of how it's
you know what?
Playing out.
For further to Dell, and you should really read the piece at mc79hockey.com. It's a brief sort of overview of what's happened to hitting. And there's the problem right there. Because somewhere along the way, body checking turned into hitting.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Body checking was once upon a time just using your body to separate that player from the puck, forcing a turnover. But now it's become and you see it obviously much more in the playoffs, where what you do in games one and two show up in games three, four, and five. It's become a physical tactic to wear down the other team. It was never like that, right? It was simply separate the man from the puck and force a turnover, right? To the point where the way the Philadelphia Flyers beat the Boston Bruins for their first Stanley Cup was, you know, the common wisdom was always, you know, keep the puck away from Bob Uecker, keep the puck away from Bob Uecker, where Fred Shearer said, no, man, we're going to dump the puck in Bob Uecker's corner. And we're going to send two men in after him, and we're going to hit him.
Mm-hmm.
And that is going to force him to throw the puck to the other side. We would much rather have Don Orry or Gary Doak skate the puck out than Bobby Orr. The
right.
tactic was actually give the puck to the superior hockey player, hit him, and force him to move it. Somewhere along the way, body checking and hitting replaced one another. Now it's hitting is the tactic. And the only ends that it really has is to weaken the other opponent
mm-hmm.
and try to get him out of the game. Whenever I hear a player say, I didn't mean to hurt him with that body check, I'm sorry. My BS radar goes off.
But there's another tactical element to it, which is the idea that you're hitting someone in order to take them off their game, not to injure them necessarily, but to take them off their game. And if you go, if you look at the, I forget where I saw it. I want to say Brody Brazil from CSN had the quotes. If you look at the quotes from the San Jose Sharks after the on their getaway day after the first round loss to the LA Kings that will result in my pieing. More on that later this week, by the way. There's some big things kicking around. Brent Burns had some really interesting comments about the idea that the physicality of that series really got the Sharks out of their element. And in the sense that they started chasing bodies more than they were chasing the puck. They were getting away from the style of hockey they played so well during the regular season to try to engage the LA Kings physically. And you can't do it. The Kings and the Bruins are the two teams that you shouldn't try to engage physically because you'll lose every time. But because they're tougher than you, and also because they're not going to stop hitting you. And if you think that they're going to somehow acquiesce, they're the ones that are going to fold, you're wrong. And so Burns said that, and that's, we're talking about a guy who throws his body around a little bit too in Burns. He said, you know, we were too consumed with the physicality of that series to really focus on what we do well offensively. And I'm wondering if he's saying that vis-a-vis being so of their own heads in the first two games of that series and then kind of losing their way after that. I wonder if that's what he's getting at. But that's what he said, and I thought that was an interesting point on hitting.
Where are you at with Subban ducking out of the way of the hit on by Thornton?
I'm fine with it. Goddamn. Survive, man. You are an MVP candidate for your team. And the rhino is charging at you. I'm okay with you ducking out of the hit. I know that there is a certain amount of valor involved and bravery involved and taking, you know, all that. Where was all this when Gretzky was playing is my question. When Gretzky was the slipperiest man on the ice and you couldn't hit him. That was the thing they always said about Gretzky.
McCurry caught him.
But wasn't that always the thing on Gretzky?
Oh, for
sure. Gretzky was like, well, why didn't someone just plaster that little bastard against the walls?
Well, it wasn't
because of Semenko and McSorley all the time. It was because you couldn't hit him. But there was the element of that, but it was because you couldn't hit him. So did we ever, if social media existed today and Gretzky was as slippery as he was back then, would we be saying the same things? Oh, look at that guy who holds every single record in the history of hockey.
You know what?
What a little weakling. Take your desserts, Gretzky.
Let me throw something else at you. I remember when I was working Hockey Night, Glenn Healy told me this on the air. So this isn't telling tales out of school. Heal said that if anyone tried to hit Gretzky, he would get shit from his own team because everybody in the league realized that Wayne Gretzky was the NHL meal ticket. And their fortunes were tied to him in some way, shape, or form. Yeah. Like, what are you doing?
That was like, that reminds me of the theory that people had about Sid when he came back. Remember the theory? The theory was that he came back from the concussion, and there was going to be this whole thing about, well, who's going to hit him? Who's going to be the first one to dare?
Remember who the first one was?
Fragile meal ticket. Refresh my memory.
It was a game against the Islanders. It was a defenseman.
Who was it?
Travis Hamonic, of course.
Oh, that's right.
Hamonic was the first guy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But, and then he's in the KHL.
Here's the thing about Gretzky too. To your point, you can't hit him because what's Delo saying? I flat out don't believe the story America's telling. Like I believe Healy said it. I just don't believe that it's true. No, that's what he said. I'm just saying that's what Healy said, Tyler.
Of course, you might have wanted to say it was a different source than Glenn Healy. I don't know if you know this, but there's a bit of criticism of Glenn Healy.
I know he's not a hockey pundit. I found this out this year on Twitter. Holy smokes, there's not a whole lot of love for Glenn Healy out there. What was the story? The point that I was just going to make a second ago. What was I talking about?
Perfectly nice guy, by the way. I would go back to our persona conversation.
Who Heals?
A lot of fans of his. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a nice guy.
Perfectly good dude.
Damn it! I was trying to make a point a second ago.
Yeah, that's all right. Listen, we have to get to the question of the day, which, of course, was
I remember. Hold on.
Oh, shit. Go, please.
Go quick.
Yes.
The thing about Gretzky, too. One of the most rare pictures you will ever see is Wayne Gretzky skating along the benches.
Mm-hmm.
Gretzky was so hyper aware of everything around him. I mean, that's why he could call, like, too many men on the ice penalty. He must have called, like, dozens of too many men on the ice calls. Just because he knew where everybody was at every single time. Like, no one saw the ice quite like Gretzky. And one of the hardest photographs to find is a picture of Gretzky skating along the boards by the benches. Why? Because he liked to set up on the other side so he would know who's coming on the ice when. Mm-hmm. That's it. He'll be watching the bench, watching on the ice.
The only time you could really catch Gretzky is if you wanted to anger Superfan 99 over there in NHL 94, 93, and make Gretzky's head bleed, like in Swingers. That's the only time you could really catch him. The question of the day that we put forth to you before the show was about catchphrases. Patrick Kane's screaming Showtime after a goal that is now going to become synonymous with him. Congratulations, you have finally shed the 20-cent label. And now we were asking you about other catchphrases in the National Hockey League for NHL stars. Before we get there, Kings of Hockeywood has a pet peeve that I'd like to run by you.
Go for it.
Okay?
Is it about area?
My pet peeve. No. Quote, he's won 2 Stanley Cups. Nope. There's only 1 Stanley Cup. Players win it multiple times.
He's won the Stanley Cup
twice. Can't win multiple cups.
He's won the Stanley Cup twice? As opposed to he's won 2 Stanley Cups.
Well, that would be the right way to say it. He's won the Stanley Cup twice is the correct way. He's won 2 Stanley Cups is not.
Well, actually, it wouldn't be he's won 2 Stanley Cups. It's he's won 2 Stanley Cups.
Oh, bite me. he has 2 rings. He has 2 Stanley Cup rings would be the perfect way to say it.
Yeah.
He's won the Stanley Cup twice is the other way to say it. He's won 2 Stanley Cups is not. It is 1 cup.
Stanley Cup.
1 dream, 1 cup. 16 teams. We asked you for catchphrases for National Hockey League players. DetroitHockey.net writes in, nuts for Milan Lucic.
Oh.
John Roberts writes in, fap time for Joe Thornton.
Fap time.
We've also had some people that are going with some like longer taglines for players.
Yeah.
Ryan Miller, courtesy of Mike from Attleboro. You can take the Buffalo, you can take the goalie out of Buffalo, but you can't take the Buffalo out of the goalie. John Lee writes in one for Matt Cook. Oops, my bad. that's actually pretty good. Alex Sheridan with a great one for Jonathan Taves. It's simply deafening silence and an awkward, intense stare would be his catchphrase. this is MVSW history. Do you want to be a spaceman for Bryzgalov? By the way, played really well in this series. I'm sort of sad that he's not. You know, the goals he gave up in game 2, I didn't think were really on him, did you?
And the Bickle. I don't know. That Bickle goal. I don't know. Like, Brian Bickle's not Mike Bossy, dude.
Well, he's not. No, he's not. I don't think.
But, man, when the playoffs start, something happens to that guy.
This is from Shiv. This is my catchphrase. Oh, yeah, it's an Instagram photo by a fan. Oh, I mean, ignorant person. Once that happens, you have to comment on it.
I think it's
in reference to the person who... That's from me.
Oh.
Because when somebody Instagrams a photo of a noose in reference to PK Subban, that's not that's not noteworthy or anything. Right? Stephen Schieffer goes a different direction on the catchphrase thing. This is more of a nickname thing, but I wanted to read it anyway because it's kind of funny. Now that Roberto Luongo is back in Florida, we can call him the accountant because his busy season will always end on April 15th.
Oh, very good. The accountant.
And then finally, let's see here. Michael Perino, versions of teams. This is another conversation we had on the show today. I was super happy when Donald Brashear failed as a Ranger, especially after he took a cheap headshot on Blair Betts in the playoffs and then remarked, I thought it was a great hit. That does speak to the idea that there are certain guys that your team acquires that you're like, I'm not down with this. This is somebody I never really wanted to see on my team, and now the entire team is sort of soured because of it. And I can imagine the Brashear thing was a point of contention for Rangers fans when he joined that team.
Probably was. But there have been other, like, when Mayday joined the Avs, there wasn't a big, I thought there'd be like, oh my God, couldn't believe when that happened, but that was fine.
Mm-hmm. But that not was, so much.
It was all right, but yeah, but the.
Now, if Claude Lemieux had joined the Red Wings.
Oof. Do you think that if Dominic, do you think that if Dominic Moore would have been like traded to the Red Wings on trade deadline that he'd refuse to play?
Say that again?
If Dominic Moore were traded this year to the Red Wings at trade deadline, You think he would have, when they were fishing for centermen, do you think he would have refused to play?
No, I think he would have played.
With Todd Bertuzzi?
Job's job.
I understand that. Family's family.
Lawsuits are lawsuits.
And how? Tick, tick.
No, I can't wait.
I don't know. I don't. There are smarter people than me. This actually be a better question for our lawyer friend, Tyler Dello. Does it get to court? I don't know. Tyler, you're listening. Chime in.
I can't imagine it will, but God, I hope it does, because I really, like I've said before, want that OJ trial for the Bertuzzi-Moore thing.
For hockey?
I want cameras in the courts. I want every single day to be coverage of that trial. It'd be fascinating.
No, I'll watch every
and
minute of it,
than
but I don't want it.
Anything else, I want that poofy-haired Jack Nicholson from A Few Good Men, Mark Crawford, to take the stand, put hand on Bible, and swear he didn't commission the Code Red. That's what I want to see. That's the moment. You're damn right I did, and I do it again. That's all I want to see.
Patrick, come on. Nobody used the catchphrase wakey wakey for the whole Hawks team.
Nope, nobody did. That's brilliant.
That's good.
That's absolutely brilliant. All right, with that, off we go. I think I'm going to be at MSG tonight for game 3 of the Rangers and Penguins. I'm in the city today.
They're just playing every game? They're just playing every day? That series just can play every day?
Well, I figure they're going to keep doing this until the Rangers just drop dead of exhaustion. But you know what's funny? Like, I understand the complaints, and I got a lot of Ranger fan friends that are like, what is this, playing all these games? Don't go 7 with the Flyers. It's a very easy fix. Finish the series in 6. You had the opportunity, and now because of that extra game you had to play, a lack of rest and a number of games and a condensed schedule. So that'll be fun. I'm looking
That's
forward to
time.
That one.
Yeah.
The goaltending duel between Fleury and Lundqvist, the rejuvenated Marc-Andre Fleury.
It was good.
Pitching shutouts in playoff games.
22 saves. Was it 22 or 23? It wasn't exactly that tested. Certainly not on the power play.
Hey,
but
I have a new Fleury theory, which is that it's great to have a goalie that you have no confidence in because it means that you'll be responsible defensively. You won't start freelancing and expecting him to do Hasekian things to save your team. You have to be great defensively if you think your goalie is a sieve.
So then explain Chris Letang's game last night, where he was all over the ice. It was great, but...
I call that the Chris Osgood theory of championship goaltending.
He actually made that Red Wings blue line that
Detroit.
Everyone loved.
I love you, Detroit. That's just jokes. Not really. Not totally, but kind of a joke.
Great. Which Greg Wyshynski is this again? We talked about the beginning of the program.
That was the trolling Detroit persona. Not the guy who goes to the Detroiter on New Year's Eve and has a wonderful time with the delightful natives of our great Motor City. That was the guy who just wants to wind up Red Wings fans.
I've said this about you before, and it's been my last thought on the podcast today. No matter what happens between you and me and this podcast and whatever fate and fortune take us, I will always say one thing about you wherever I go for as long as I shall live. Greg Wyshynski, you're a nice bunch of guys.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, sir.
Nice bunch of guys.
And finally, being at Cinco de Mayo, your favorite number 5?
Bill Barocco, probably.
All right.
How about you?
Obviously, mine is not Danny Potvin. Obviously, mine is... I'll go with the great hockey name for my favorite number 5 today. I'm not going to go with Lidstrom. Everybody would say Lidstrom. I'll go with one of my favorite hockey names, Garth Butcher. Because honestly...
It's a great name.
Right?
It is a pretty good name. You know what, though?
A quintessential Canadian first name and a last name that means cleaving flesh.
That means cleaving flesh? You know what, though? Frick, man. I might go Danny Potvin. Who almost, by the way, became a Ranger.
We know.
Mm-hmm.
Don't go down this. Don't start.
Down the history well?
Don't repeat yet, man. Dude, wait until the summer.
Speaking of which, we should get, because it was Mike Keenan who's going to bring him out of retirement. Tried to, anyhow. We should get, Maddie and I were just talking about this before the show. We should get Keenan on the program. Right, Maddie? Yeah.
Yes.
We're getting
Mike
on the
show.
Oh, my
God, absolutely. Talk about that video that we put on Puck Day.
him dancing,
I mean, the
doing
Russian
karaoke,
but also the Russian karaoke, but also him going crazy and trying to almost fight a Russian security guard.
Firing up his team, bud. I'll tell you, you have not lived until you've heard Mike Keenan sing "Easy" by the Commodores. It is the single greatest thing ever. And whenever he works with us, he's
better
always,
chance
always
that,
singing it.
Better chance that Keenan or Tortorella ends up in Florida.
Well, the real answer, I think, is neither. But,
But, hey, what about Vinny Viola? Whole family is Rangers fans. Don't you think that they're going to go out and get a Rangers guy?
You do know who the goalie is, right? And Tort's kind of had him run out.
You know,
it's
going to be Tortorella.
Then, yeah, but don't forget, Keenan had him traded.
There's a lot of old school Rangers guys they could get. They could get Adam Graves.
Is this going to be like a new,
by the way,
impression?
The
miscellaneous Viola family member in Florida? It's going to be a new one for you? Tied with the first overall pick.
I like this Jonathan Huberdeau, but we're going to trade him for Steve Larmer, the righteous Steve Larmer. That guy's a gamer. That guy knows how to win.
This time was Stefan Matteau.
Only reason I bought this freaking team is because John Van Beesbrouck was one of the goalies.
Okay, that's pretty good.
Listen. All right, with that, we'll call it a show. Thanks to Trip Tracy for joining us. Thanks to all of you for chiming in as usual. And we will talk to you on the morrow, ladies and gentlemen. When I believe tomorrow is Jack Adams Day, which will be very interesting. I'm guessing Wah. I'm guessing Cooper. And I'm guessing Babs.
That's right. I think this is the year he finally gets some more love for getting that deal. We're going to ask
probably
Cooper
will.
To come
on. But it'll be contingent on what the broadcasters think.
Here, let's put some pressure on Maddie. Maddie, do something. I'm going to ask Cooper if he'll come on to me tomorrow. Let's see if we can get Coop on tomorrow.
Oh, Coop.
Pressure's on you, Maddie.
That'd be really cool.
Get the Coop.
Oh, and by the way, the last thing I want to say on the show today is that Chuck Gormley has a story about the talks between the Capitals and Wayne Gretzky, and I think that's great. I hope that Gretzky does bring some gravitas to a role as someone who heads up the organization, and I hope he is able to surround himself with really great hockey people.
Yes.
However, if one of those hockey people is Mark Messier, I will predict torches, flames, and a burning Verizon Center from Capitals fans.
Why is that?
The idea that a Gretzky-Messier duo is somehow something that that people want is insane. If you swap out George McPhee, who's been there since the Mesozoic era, for a novice general manager in Mark Messier?
Yeah.
Come on. That's not what you're going to do,
and
is
didn't
it,
Messier,
Capitals,
hang on,
Teddy?
Didn't Messier turn down Washington to go to Vancouver?
As far as the trade goes or the signing goes?
Signing, yeah. Someone who's a much better Caps historian is going to tweak me on that on Twitter. Please do.
Oh, I remember Pierre Turgeon used the Caps to up his price at one point. I don't know if Messier did the same thing. But I'm sorry. I'm all for Gretzky taking over the team, whatever. But if this is going to be another one of those situations where now it's Gretzky's boys.
As a playpen? Yeah.
Like, as a playpen? Like his former agent becomes a GM again? That kind of thing?
That would never happen. Oh, wait a minute. It did happen to Phoenix.
Yep. But, there you go. Yeah, Gretzky and Messier. Unless one of them is going to strap on the skates and skate behind Nicky Backstrom. Let's just keep it at Gretzky as president and get a suit in there as the GM. All right, everybody. Thanks for your time. We will talk to you tomorrow. Bye.